evening. My name is Nick Palmer, and I am a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. Amen. And before I get started, I'd just like to thank Tom and the committee for inviting me down here. It's always an honor and a privilege to share my story. And I'd like to thank Don. As Don said, he picked me up at the airport. He fed me very well. He rode me up here, and he treated me very nicely, despite the fact that I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which makes me a damn Yankee and a Pittsburgh Steeler fan. I wanted to get that out of the way right from the start. You know, I heard Jerry Jones speak a couple years ago, and he talked about Texas hospitality, and I never understood what he was talking about until I experienced it, so thank you. You know, we come here tonight, we're all very different people. I was a construction worker for 40 years. I'm guessing that most of you weren't. I'm also guessing that we have different religious affiliations. I think if I stood up here and shared my political views, it'd probably make the hair on most of the back of your neck stand on end. We have different educational levels. I got a friend who was, he was telling his sponsor about how smart he was because he had a degree in this and a degree in that, and he had his master's in this other thing. And his sponsor explained to him, you know, they put degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them. I'm probably older than most of you, not Big Al, but I'm probably older than most of the rest of you. Some of us are of different races. We have different amounts of wealth, different social status, different living standards, different amounts of time in the program, different intellects, different hobbies. But you know, the one thing that we all have in common is that alcoholism just beat the snot out of every one of us. We have a common problem, and thank God we have a common solution. We don't come here tonight because of our triumphs, but out of our failures. You know, our brokenness is what bonds us. It's how we identify with each other man to man. And it's a strong bond. I lived with alcoholism for years, and I had no clue what it was. To me, it was a moral issue. I thought a person who was an alcoholic lived under a bridge and drank out of a paper bag. And I certainly wouldn't have somebody like that living in my house, let alone sleeping in my bed. But I did. I'm here tonight to share my experience, strength, and hope. And my experience, simply put, was that my wife drank and I got brain damage. I can't explain that. I just know that it happened. I come from a family of drinkers. Everybody in my family drank. It's just the way it was. That was normal to me. I thought it was normal for everyone. In fact, when I was 13 years old, my mother told me that you can't trust people that don't drink. And I got to tell you, I've met some of the nicest untrustworthy people since I've been here in Texas. Anyway, when I was 15, I became trustworthy and I started drinking. And I drank all through high school, and I drank a lot. When I graduated from high school, I went to a small college in Pennsylvania, and there was three women for every man. I thought I'd died and went to heaven. After college, I married my college sweetheart. That was 1 year of college, and she was pregnant. And we had a little girl. We struggled financially for several years because I had no marketable skills. Then I got into an electrical apprenticeship. My future was a little more secured, and we had a little boy. Early in my marriage, my wife drank very little. She had 3 or 4 glasses of wine a year. My drinking, on the other hand, bothered my wife. If I'd stop and have a few beers with my friends, she'd get upset. And if we went someplace where they had alcohol, she'd count the number of drinks I had because I had to drive home. And this went on for the first 8 years of our marriage. Then on our 8th wedding anniversary, I asked my wife, what would you like to do to celebrate our anniversary? And she said, well, you know, I've never gone to see an X-rated movie. So I took her to see an X-rated movie, and then we went out to dinner. Well, that X-rated movie seemed to have had a profound effect upon her. Because I asked her if she wanted a drink. She said, yes, so I ordered a bottle of wine. That wine was gone before the food was on the table. So I ordered another bottle of wine. When dinner was finished, she started getting a little loud. I figured I'd better get her out of there. And so I paid the bill, and we stood up to leave, and she was a little bit wobbly. So I put my arm around her, and we started out of the restaurant. We got halfway across the restaurant. She stopped walking. I said, what's wrong? She said, my legs won't work. So I picked her up and put her over my shoulder like a saddlebag, and I carried her out to the car. Now, I got to tell you, I wasn't ashamed or embarrassed because she was starting to act like my family. And I drove her home, and on the way home, I thought, you know, it's our anniversary. We've gone to see an X-rated movie, and now she's drunk. Tonight's going to be my lucky night. She was puking before we got in the door. But my wife went from a person who drank 3 or 4 glasses of wine a year to a person that was falling down drunk 7 days a week in 6 months' time. That's how fast alcoholism grabbed a hold of her. And at first it didn't bother me. I thought it was great. I had somebody I could drink with. But it started getting old because she was drunk every day. And so I asked her to slow down. She didn't slow down. I demanded that she slow down. She didn't slow down. I pleaded with her to slow down. She didn't slow down. I tried to reason with her. She didn't slow down. I even tried to sit and drink with her, but that did nothing but piss her off because I was drinking her wine. It didn't slow her down, though. Finally, I started marking bottles so I could point out to her just how much she was drinking. And when I started marking bottles, we started playing childish games. We played hide and seek. She'd hide the bottle and I'd seek it. And when I found it, I dumped it out. And you know, it wasn't until I came into Al-Anon that someone pointed out to me that all I was doing was wasting money because she'd have more wine the next day. I don't know how it started or when it started, but I started to obsess about my wife. I'd go to work and I'd wonder where she was, what she was doing, who she was with. Was she drinking? Was she buying booze? And I would come home and she'd be perfectly fine because her pattern of drinking was that she didn't start drinking until I came home from work. There seemed to be something about me that made her drink. By the time I came home from work, I had myself so worked up. We had many fights. And I got to tell you, I started almost every one of them. And it wasn't that I liked the fight, I just couldn't seem to help myself. And I'd get her all fired up, and then I'd want to be done fighting, and I'd go in the next room. And she'd be right on my heels like a little Mexican chihuahua. And I'd go in the next room, and she'd be right on my heels. And finally, in desperation, just to get away from her, I'd run out and jump in my car and tear off down the street. And I'd get a block down the street, and I'd say to myself, where are you going? Because I had no place to go, and I had no one to talk to. Living with alcoholism filled me with anger and resentment, frustration, fear, guilt, shame, and embarrassment. But the worst thing about living with alcoholism was the loneliness. As I said, there was simply no one to talk to. And it wasn't that people wouldn't talk to me. I didn't want to talk to them. I didn't want them to know what was going on in my home. We get invited someplace where I knew they were serving alcohol, and they'd say, why don't you come over this night? And I'd say, well, we'd love to, but I have other plans. We have other plans that night. We didn't have any other plans. So I became a liar. You know, I learned when I came into the program that you can tell when an alcoholic is lying when their lips are moving. Well, my lips were moving too. I tried every way I could to control my wife. I thought by physical size alone, I should be able to pretty much dictate what she did. I mean, at the height of her drinking, she weighed 87 pounds, and I weighed more than that. I could not control her drinking. I told you I obsessed about my wife. I checked the distance from our house to all the local liquor stores. And then in the morning before I went to work, I'd check the speedometer, and I'd check it again when I came home from work. Because I wanted to know where she was buying her booze. Now, I don't know what in the hell I was going to do with this information, but it seemed important at the time. I even tried to control her by withholding sex. That didn't work at all. She never even noticed. And I gave that up after about a day and a half. Finally, she started having these panic attacks. And I didn't know what to do with her, so I took her to the family doctor. The family doctor didn't seem to know what to do with her, so he sent her to a therapist. I took her to her first therapy session, and she went in and talked to the therapist and came out, and I went in and talked to the therapist. The therapist said, what do you think your wife's problem is? And I said, well, she drinks too much. And the therapist said, no, she has issues. And we'll work through the issues and the drinking will go away. Well, this was a trained professional. This was somebody that would know these kind of things. So I sent her off to the therapist. And this was in the late 70s. It cost $50 a week for her to go to see this therapist, which that was a lot of money to me at the time. And finally, after 6 months, she came home and said, the therapist would like to see you next week. So I went in to see the therapist, and the therapist said, you know, Mr. Palmer, until you get your wife to quit drinking, I can't help her. Well, she never went back to see that therapist. But as I said, this was a trained professional. This was somebody who would know these kind of things. And she said it was up to me to get her to quit drinking. Well, for the next couple years, our lives together just circled the drain. We were going nowhere. And finally, I came home from work one snowy February. There was about 8 inches of snow on the ground. And I walked into my house and my wife was drunk. Now, I hear people in Al-Anon say that when their spouse came home from work, they'd go over and give them a kiss to smell their breath to see if they were drinking. I never had to do that. Because when my wife drank, she put on lipstick and she missed her lips. She had lipstick all over her mouth. And I said, "I'm not living like this anymore. You're going to have to leave." And she said, "I'm not leaving." And I said, "Oh, yes, you are." And I picked her up and I carried her out and I threw her in the snow. Well, it was like putting a cat out. She was back inside before I was. But you know, I was ashamed and embarrassed because I was raised that you never touch a woman. And that's where the family disease of alcoholism took me. I was trying to control another person. I can't even control myself. I got a little granddaughter, and I'm just crazy about her. And when she was 3 years old, she'd be over at the house, and I'd say to her, "It's time for your nap." And she'd say, "I don't want to take a nap." And I'd say, "Well, you have to take a nap." And I could put her in bed, but I couldn't make her fall asleep. If I can't control a three-year-old, I don't know what chance I had at trying to control my wife. It just... no chance at all. Anyway, my wife was back inside, and she called her friend, and her friend came over and knocked on the door. I answered the door, and her friend said, "Is she drunk again?" I was shocked. That was my secret. I didn't know anyone else knew that she drank. Anyway, I said yes, and she came in. Unbeknownst to me, this friend of hers was married to an alcoholic. And she was carrying around the number for AA to give to her husband at the opportune time. Instead of giving it to her husband, she gave the number to my wife. And my wife made the call to AA that night. The next night, somebody came to the house and took my wife to her first AA meeting. When she came home, I took her out in the kitchen, sat her down. I said, "Now, what did you learn at your first AA meeting?" And she said, "I learned you're sicker than I am and you need to go to Al-Anon." I learned that night that all they do in AA is talk about us. I just... Anyway, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting that Friday night. And I walked in and there was 35 women and about 4 guys. And I got to tell you, I was intimidated. I had all the problems I could stand with one woman. I didn't need 35 more. But you know, God gave me the gift of desperation that night, and I went in anyway. And I started talking to one of the guys. He was a few years younger than me. And he was very spiritual. And I tell you that because it turned out to be a large part of my recovery. I talked to him quite a bit that night, and he seemed like a pretty good guy, and we started going to meetings together. Eventually, I asked him to be my sponsor, and we went to all the local meetings, and then we started traveling to all the meetings in the Pittsburgh area. He lived a little distance from me, so we'd meet somewhere in the middle. We'd park one of the cars in the parking lot, and we'd go to the meeting. Now, the meetings all started at 9 o'clock at the time. And so we'd meet about 8 o'clock, and on the way to the meeting, we talked about my life and the events of my life. And it was through my sponsor's eyes that I began to see that there was a power greater than myself that was working in my life and had been working in my life all along. Because it seemed like every time I got into some kind of a jackpot, my life would go in a different direction. It was literally a turning point in my life. And 6 months down the road from that turning point, my life was in a much better place than it would have been if I'd stayed on the same path. And I began to see that God was working in my life, and it was during this period of time I took the first three steps. But I stopped there because that fourth step scared me. I didn't want to look at me. We'd go to the meeting. After the meeting, we'd stop and have coffee and ice cream or coffee and pie. And then we'd ride home and we'd talk some more about my life and the events of my life. And then when we got back to the parking lot, we started praying together. And I know if people had driven by and seen two guys sitting in a dark parking lot late at night, they had their idea of what was going on. I'm here to tell you we were praying. You know, I was new at the time in the program, and I recently found out that the word new means nothing else works. And isn't that the truth? I thought coming to Al-Anon was the lamest thing in the world. I mean, I was a construction worker. That men don't ask for help, and they don't ask for directions, and I was asking for help. Anyway, those early meetings were wonderful learning experiences. At the first meeting that I went to, I learned the three C's. I didn't cause the alcoholism, I couldn't control it, and I couldn't cure it. And when I could accept these in my heart, it started to lift the weight off of me. Later on, I learned about the fourth C. I couldn't compete with alcohol. Alcohol was my wife's lover, her companion, her confidant, her seducer, her confessor. It was her everything. And I couldn't compete with alcohol on any level. I learned that alcoholism is a disease. Now, I seen a sign in a bar room years earlier that said, "Alcoholism is a disease. Get your shots here." I thought it was a big joke. But I truly came to believe that alcoholism is a disease. And not only is it a disease, it's a highly contagious disease. When somebody in your household suffers from the disease of alcoholism, everybody gets sick. I learned that it's easy to see what the alcohol is doing to the alcoholic, but it's almost impossible to see what it's doing to us. I was talking to a lady early in the program, and I was telling her how I was absolutely obsessed with my wife and acting crazy and how my wife was falling down drunk every day. She said to me, "Well, who's raising your kids?" I said, "What do you mean, who's raising my kids?" And she said, "Well, you're acting crazy and you're obsessed with your wife. Your wife's falling down drunk. Who's raising your kids?" For the first time, I realized my kids were raising themselves. One of the early meetings I went to was on detachment. And somebody spoke for 10 or 12 minutes, and then we went around the room and shared. When it came to this one lady's turn to share, she said that when her husband and her were having an argument, and he said something to push her buttons, she would say, "I'm sorry you feel that way." And the argument was diffused. And I thought, boy, that's so easy. That's simple. Why didn't I think of that? I'll use that in my life. A couple days later, when we were having an argument, my wife said something to push my buttons. I said, I'm sorry you feel that way, asshole. I didn't learn that in Al-Anon. But what I did learn is that if I want to detach, I have to detach from a point of strength. I can't detach from a point of weakness. You know, we talk about HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, and I have to avoid these things because if I don't, I'm vulnerable. I can get sucked right into an argument. The way I became strong is I went to lots of meetings. I worked the steps with my sponsor. And I started to develop an intimate relationship with my higher power. And when I did these things, I was able to say, I'm sorry you feel that way, dear. But you know, that strength that I needed to detach with, that was not a one-trick pony. I could use that for a lot of the things that we talk about in our program. I could use that for handling fear and compassion, decision-making, tolerance, patience, acceptance. I continued to go to the program, and, you know, it was amazing to me that in the early meetings, every meeting seemed to be exactly what I needed. It was just uncanny. It wasn't until years later I discovered that I was so sick, it wouldn't matter what the meeting was on. It was exactly what I needed. I was in the program for about a year and a half. I came home from work one Friday night. My wife wasn't home. Dinner time came and went, and she still wasn't home. Finally, about 6:30 or 6:45, she called, and she was drunk, and she informed me that she was on her way to California, the land of fruits and nuts. And I was devastated. I found out the next day that she had left with a fellow that she met in AA. But I tried to call my sponsor. Well, this was 1983. We didn't have cell phones at the time, and I couldn't get a hold of them. And so I decided that what I needed to do is I needed to go out to my home group that night early, and maybe there'd be someone I could talk with. So I went out about 8 o'clock. The only people that were there were five or six newcomers that were there for the newcomers meeting. The person who was supposed to chair the newcomers meeting didn't show up that night. Now, Al-Anon's newcomers meetings were very simple at the time. Al-Anon had a series of six tapes. And you'd open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer, put one of the tapes in the tape recorder. When the tape was over, ask if there was any questions and close with the Lord's Prayer. And I thought, well, I'll chair the newcomers meeting, and maybe there'd be somebody there by then that I could talk with. So I opened the meeting with the Serenity Prayer, put the tape in the tape recorder. In about 30 seconds, the tape recorder ate the tape. And so I had to share with those newcomers my experience, strength, and hope. At the end of that meeting, I felt significantly better. By trying to share with them hope, I found hope. And by trying to share with them strength, I found strength. And I learned that night that a very large portion of our own recovery comes from reaching out to help others. I don't know if any of those newcomers ever came back, by the way, but I felt better. Well, my wife was gone, and I decided that I was not going to let this event, this thing that she did, destroy me. And so I decided to do my fourth step. Al-Anon has a blue book called The Blueprint for Progress. And it's how a lot of us in Al-Anon do our fourth step. There's a lot of personal questions in there. So I would come home from work. Me and the kids would have dinner. And then I'd sit out on my deck and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And this had two significant effects upon my life. The first being that it gave me the discipline to put the focus on me. There wasn't one question about my wife in that blueprint for progress. And the second thing it did was I found more out about me than I ever would have known. You know, people in the outside world don't ever look at themselves, especially if they're married to alcoholics. Alcoholics make such easy targets, and you can blame them for everything. But for the first time, I looked at me, and I found out that I was a very frightened, very self-centered. I just found out a lot of things about me that I wouldn't have known. Well, my wife was gone, and I continued to go to the program. And I went to a meeting one night, and I came home around 11 o'clock. My kids were staying at the grandparents at this time. And as I came home, I noticed there was a strange car in my driveway, and there were lights on in my house. I walked into my kitchen. Out of my living room walked this fellow. All he had on was his underwear. Don't we just love it when we have an opportunity to work our program? I'd like to tell you that's just what I did, but the truth of the matter is I had an Al-Anon slip. I tried to kill him. Now, fortunately for him and fortunately for me, he was able to escape out into the night. I went into the living room, and he had his clothes all neatly folded in a pile. I got a pair of scissors and cut them up. Then I went down the driveway, and I beat up his car a little bit. And this fellow was a salesman. He had all his sales books in the back seat. I took all them out and threw them in the garbage can. And then I went up in the house, and I got all my wife's clothes, and I put them in the back seat where the sales books had been. And I guess my wife was upstairs taking a bath, getting cleaned up for this fella. He eventually came back. He told me he was sorry. I agreed with him. And I sent them on their way. Over the next couple weeks, my wife called me numerous times. She told me how sorry she was, and she told me all she wanted to do was come home and be my wife. Eventually, I took her back. She had to go to a halfway house for a little while, and I took her back, and she wasn't home very long. And her and this fella, I called him my husband-in-law by now. I took off and went back out to California. And I entered the darkest period of my life. But I continued to go to the program. And I went out to my home group one Friday night. And two carloads of people from a meeting across town that my sponsor and I had gone to came out to my home group to support me. That's the kind of love and support and understanding we have in the program. After the meeting, we all went out to a restaurant. One of the people that came out to support me was a young lady that I didn't even know. I'd seen her around. I may have said hi to her a couple times, but I never had a conversation with her. And we happened to sit next to each other at the restaurant, and we started talking, and we found out we had a lot of things in common. I mean, they were simple things. She had three sisters and a brother named Joe, and I had three sisters and a brother named Joe. Her mother's name was Betty. My mother's name was Betty. She'd been married about the same length of time that I had been married, and she had two teenagers, a girl and a boy, with the girl being the oldest, and I had the same thing. And we started comparing notes, and I got her phone number, and I called her up, and I made a date with her. I took her to dinner and a movie. And the movie was about a drunk. I wanted her to feel comfortable, feel at ease, let her hair down. And you know, we've been married, it'll be 28 years in July. And, you know, I really deserve that applause because, as most of you know, just how hard it is to be married to an Al-Anon. You can't get away with anything. Anyway, she is absolutely the most wonderful person a man could have for a wife. And God and that fellow that my first wife ran off with did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Well, my oldest daughter graduated from high school. She started seeing this fellow that was kind of abusive. And the first thing you know, she was pregnant. She had a little boy. My new wife and I both love little children. And we used to get this little boy from the time he was brand new out of the hospital on Friday night till Sunday night. And we take him to church on Sunday morning, and this little boy kind of looked like me. He had the pumpkin head. And my wife would be holding him in church, and women would come up and say, "I didn't even know you were pregnant." She only smiled. Anyway, when he was 13 months old, the Children and Youth Service in Pittsburgh removed him from my daughter's home. Called me up and said, "We have your grandson over here at the police station. Come pick him up." And when I picked him up, he had a dirty diaper and no shoes, and that's the way we got him. Over the next 5 years, the Children and Youth Service terminated the father's parental rights. My daughter signed her parental rights away, and we adopted this little kid. Now, my wife and I were both in Al-Anon. We knew about the disease of alcoholism. And this little boy had a bad family tree on both sides of his family. And we wanted to be the best parents we could be. We wanted him to grow up to be a God-fearing, productive citizen. And so we took him to Little League. We took him to Cub Scouts. We went to church every Sunday. We prayed at our meals. My wife read to him every night. And along the way of raising him, we dropped out of Al-Anon because we didn't have any alcoholism in our life. We thought we were cured. We even took this little boy to a child psychologist every couple of years to make sure we were on the right track. And when he was 12 years old, he started drinking and drugging. And you know, there's not another thing that we could have done that would have made a difference in this little boy's life. These were the decisions that he made. And when he started drinking and drugging, we entered into the craziest period of our life. He didn't have any money to buy drugs and alcohol, so he used ours. I have $100 in my wallet, and I'd look at my wallet and there'd be $60 in there. And I'd say, "Were you in my wallet?" And he'd get so insulted. I mean, he was just an excellent liar. And so I'd ask my wife, and she'd say, "No, I wasn't in your wallet." And then I'd try to figure out where I spent it. He had my wife and I blaming each other. I mean, this was a young teenager. He had to listen to his parents, right? My wife is on the phone constantly with the police and the school counselor and the drug counselor. And when he was 15 years old, he went into AA. And my wife and I knew we were in trouble, and we came right back to the rooms of Al-Anon. And the people were there for us. They loved us. They were glad to see us. We weren't glad to see them, but they were glad to see us. And they just loved us, even though we were as nutty as fruitcakes. I wasn't back in the program very long, and I started to get a lot out of the program. I guess it was kind of like riding a bike. I started picking it up. And I felt a debt of gratitude to Al-Anon. And I thought what I needed to do was I needed to get back into service. And I got so much out of service that I only dug myself a deeper hole, but it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. I met wonderful people that I never would have met in service. And service allowed me to get out of myself and over myself. And I will tell you that the greatest periods of growth that I've had in the program was when I was most involved in service. Our young son that we adopted eventually graduated from high school. And he never fell in love with AA. He was in and out of AA. And so when he graduated from high school, he wanted to get his own apartment. My wife and I helped furnish the apartment for him. And he was in that apartment for 1 month, and he got thrown out because he was drinking. And he was living in his truck. Winter was coming on, and he called up one day and said, "Think I could come out to the house and wash my clothes and take a shower?" Well, that was our baby. And we said, yes, he could do that. And then he said, "You think you could pick me up? I don't have any money to put gas in my truck." And I said, "Okay, I'll pick you up." So he told me where his truck was parked. I went and picked him up. He came out to the house. He washed his clothes. He took a shower. My wife fixed a nice dinner. And after dinner, he said, "You think I could spend the night?" And we had to say no, because he was drinking. And it was hard. It was our baby. And so he gathered up his stuff, and I drove him back to where his truck was parked. And as he got out of the car, that cold night air hit me in the face, and I knew that my little boy was going to spend the night out there in the cold. And it was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. And as I drove home, I had tears running down my face. And you know, he doesn't remember a damn minute of it. He was in a blackout. But the pain that I put myself through was just incredible. Well, he went back into AA shortly after that, and we allowed him to come home. And going back into AA was just a ploy to get his foot in the door, because he went out shortly after he came home and got arrested for public intoxication and fighting with a cop. And that was our first experience of having someone in our family arrested. And he was allowed a collect phone call, and he called for a week, and we wouldn't accept the charges. But instead, we went to lots of Al-Anon meetings. We went to meetings where we didn't know a soul, and the people there just were there for us. They supported us. They understood. After a week, they released him. He came home. He decided what he needed to do was go out and reconnect with his biological mother, who was my daughter. She was living out in California. He went out to California for almost a year, and he came home because there was no work out there. And he came home with the understanding that we would tolerate no drinking or drugging in our house. And he was drinking and drugging in our house, and we knew it. We didn't have the heart to put him out. And one day when my grandchildren were over at the house, they were 4 and 5 at the time, he OD'd on the living room couch. My wife called 911. The police showed up before the paramedics got there. And me and a cop beat on my son's chest to keep his heart beating long enough for the paramedics to get there. The paramedics got there, they revived him and took him to the hospital. And we gathered up my son's belongings and took him down and put him on his bed at the hospital. By trying to give him a softer, kinder way, it damn near killed him. Over the next two or three years, my son lived on a lot of people's couches. He lived on the street. He lived in a homeless shelter for a while. He's doing a little better now. He has a job. He has his own apartment. But he's still drinking. And I don't know if he's ever going to make it. He knows where the rooms are. He knows what the solution is. But I know that I'm going to make it because I have a program. And that program is very important to me. You know, I told you that I was very lonely prior to coming into the program. If I would try to tell somebody what was going on in my home, the reactions I would get would be something like, I wouldn't put up with that. I put my foot down. I throw the bum out. Or what you should have done. And so I just shut people out of my life. And I came into the program and people were talking about what I was feeling. And one day I shared with this lady about what was going on in my home and how I was feeling, and she said, I know. She understood because she'd been there too. And I came to realize shortly thereafter that there was a lot of people in that program that knew, because they had experienced it also. And it came to me that coming to an Al-Anon meeting was a place that was like coming home. There was people I could talk with. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful place to be. It was absolutely wonderful. As I said, I could talk to the people at a meeting, and I got a friend that says if it's mentionable, it's manageable. If I can talk about the pain I'm experiencing, it'll cut it in half. And if I can talk about the joy I'm experiencing, it'll multiply it. But when I leave it bottled up inside of me, it'll fester and poison me. It'll cause me to be bitter and angry and resentful. But as I said, when I came into an Al-Anon meeting, it was like coming home. And, you know, it's a wonderful feeling to know that I got doors to my home right here in Texas. Right here in Texas. You know, I've had a wonderful spiritual journey in Al-Anon. I learned early on that God wanted me to be happy. I didn't know that. I learned that God wanted only the very best for me. I didn't know that either. And I learned that God loves me more than I will ever understand. And I look at my wife and I know God loves me. I look at my grandchildren and I know God loves me. And I look out at you fine folks and I know God loves me. I went to a meeting recently where a lady said, you know, life isn't fair. And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, well, thank God it's not fair, because if it was fair, I'd have to start giving things back. You know, we're a 12-step programs. We're 12-step programs. And you know, every one of those steps is a spiritual experience. And I don't have time to talk about all the steps, but I'm just going to talk a little bit about the third step. When I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, God accepted me right where I was. I didn't have to get righteous. I didn't have to get pious. I didn't have to get holy. He accepted me right where I was. And, you know, when I turned my will over to God, my will is my mind and my life, which is the world and the people in it. When I turned them over to God, my life's pretty good. It makes no sense to turn just my will over and hold on to my kids' lives and try to fix them. One of my hobbies is stained glass. And I was in a stained glass store a number of years ago, and there was a sign there that said, we repair stained glass windows. And they cost $10 an hour. And the sign said, if you watch, it's $50 an hour, and if you help, it's $100 an hour. And you know, I have two alcoholic sons, and if I turn them over to God and let God fix them, I get off cheap, spiritually and emotionally. If I have to watch to make sure God's doing it right, I pay a big price. And if I have to take them back off of God and fix them myself, I pay a huge price. My life today with God is like God and I are in a rowboat. God's on the rudder, that's the steering part, and I'm on the oars, that's the work part. And we're having a good time. We're going all over the lake, and life's good. And then I say to God, hey, how about trading me places? And God says, sure, because God gives me a free will. And so then I get on the rudder, and God gets on the oars. And then we just sit there, because God don't row. I got a friend that says you can't pray your socks on. You may want your socks on, but you better put them on yourself because God's not going to do it. He doesn't row and he doesn't put socks on. And you know, when I turn my sons over to God, it's not like I'm turning them over to the enemy. God loves them more than I will ever love them. And today I know that it's God's job to take care of my sons. But I also know it's my job to get out of God's way. You know, my oldest son, I think it's next Wednesday, he'll celebrate 9 months of good AA sobriety. He has a sponsor, he has a home group, and he's working the steps with his sponsor. And I would like to take this opportunity to thank every one of you for being there for my son. You gave me my son back to me. And I promise you that if one of your loved ones ever comes into an Al-Anon meeting, I'll be there for them. You know, I went to an Al-Anon meeting that was close to where I grew up a number of years ago. And there was an AA meeting there at the same time. And I went into the AA meeting to get a cup of coffee. I used to have the attitude they shared the disease with me. At least they could do is share a cup of coffee. And I went in and I ran into three fellows that I used to drink with in high school. And we stood there and reminisced, and then it was time for the meeting to start, so I took my cup of coffee and I walked down the hall toward the Al-Anon meeting. And as I walked down the hall, I thought, why me? Why am I in the rooms of Al-Anon and not in the rooms of AA? What was the difference? How did I dodge the bullet? And as I continued to walk down the hall, I thought, what a privilege. What a privilege it is to be in Al-Anon. But then, you know, I started thinking, you know, God didn't bring me through living with alcoholism and bring me into the rooms of Al-Anon so I could live happily ever after. It's up to me to make sure that the program is here for the next person. You know, I got a little granddaughter, and I just love her to pieces. But she is such a fixer and such a manipulator, and she makes excuses for a little brother. And she's going to be in these rooms someday. And it's up to me to make sure that the program of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions is here for her. You know, that little granddaughter was over at my house when she was 3 years old one day. And it was a nice summer day, and so I took her for a walk in the woods down behind my house. And we walked for quite a way, and then there was a log across the path, and we sat down. And I said to her, I said, do you know where you are? And she said, no. And I said, do you know which way home is? And she said, no. And I said, well, then you must be lost. And she said, I'm not lost. I'm with you. And I will tell you, I'm not lost anymore either. I'm with you. Thank you.